We'll hear oral argument now in the case of Cooper against the IBM Personal Pension Plan.
May it please the Court, Jeffrey Huvel on behalf of the IBM Personal Pension Plan and IBM. IBM's cash balance plan complies with ERISA 204B1H for two principal reasons. First, under the plan, all employees, regardless of age, earn benefits in exactly the same way. All employees receive pay credits at the same rate, and all employees earn interest credits at the same rate. As a result, their account balance, which is the sum of their pay credits and interest credits, grows at exactly the same rate. Second, under the plan, all employees earn benefits of equal economic value. The fact that interest is provided does not change this result. Interest provides no economic advantage to a younger employee over an older employee. Interest simply preserves the value of the benefit against the time value of money. Under IBM's plan, the rate of interest is the rate specified by Treasury in Notice 96-8. This is a rate that Treasury has explained results in the account balance being equal, actuarial equivalent, to the future benefit at age 65, including all of the interest accumulated to that date.
Does Treasury specify an interest rate that effectively takes out the tax benefit? I mean, the great benefit of putting money in a pension plan when you're 25 is that taxes are deferred for 40 years. Deferring taxes is highly valuable. That's why these plans are structured as they are, as pre-tax rather than post-tax income. So when the IRS specifies an allowable interest rate, does it try to take the tax benefit of deferral out?
Well, I don't know if it... I think what you're asking is an advantage of someone in the plan versus someone outside of the plan. Mm-hmm. And as I understand what Treasury has done, it has specified a rate which ensures that for people within the plan, the present value of their account balance is actuarially equivalent to what another employee would receive by accumulating interest within the plan. So I think that they accomplish the purpose of ensuring that that interest don't give an advantage.
Let me ask the question another way. If you look at the interest rate that's imputed on these plans, how does that compare with the actual rate of interest that would actually be earned on a defined contribution plan that had been invested, say, in a bond fund managed by Vanguard?
I can tell you what the interest rate is under the IBM plan, which is 1 year treasuries plus 1%.
Right. So it sounds like the interest rate that would be earned on a defined contribution plan invested in real bonds would be materially higher than treasury plus 1%.
Correct.
Alternatively, one could say that the treasury is expressing the view that IBM is essentially a risk-free, failure-proof firm. Strikes me as unlikely, but...
Well, I think in this instance, Your Honor, what we have is Treasury having made a judgment.
The other way of putting this is that given that, the young people are actually being undercompensated for the real economic risk they're bearing.
Well, the point that is true, which the district court missed entirely, is that interest gives the young people no economic advantage over the old people, older employees, and that was the premise for the court's decision. And the fact that Treasury has determined that this is an appropriate interest rate and ensures that the account balance is of equal value to the projected benefit at age 65 should
so
be sufficient.
It may not be the best deal, but it's the same deal. Is that the way it works?
Right, and it's the deal that Treasury has said is the appropriate deal and that it, that protects all employees. The plaintiffs, under our interpretation of the statute imposes a fairly simple requirement, and the statute was addressed to a particular problem. The problem the statute was addressed to was the fact that prior to 1986, under many plans, employees earned no further benefits after they reached a certain age, usually age 65. If workers chose to continue working, they earned no further benefits. What this statute says is however you calculate benefits, you cannot stop doing it just because an employee attains a certain age. And you cannot reduce the rate of accrual just because the employee attains a certain age. Plaintiffs read the statute.
Has anyone ever applied this analysis to a defined contribution plan? I ask that. I'm going to ask this of Mr. Freeman. I ask that because it looks like Section 204B2A has a materially identical rule for defined contribution plans. And if the district judge is right that this structure for a defined benefit plan violates ERISA, then it seems to me that every defined contribution plan that has ever existed has violated ERISA. Now, one would think that would probably draw some litigation someplace.
Well, we think that to the extent that the accrual pattern is similar in the two plans, it makes no sense at all to say that it's impermissible in one kind of plan but permissible in another kind.
Well, look, I don't care what sense it makes. I just care how the statute applies to it. And I gather from your answer that you have not focused on Section 204B2A and how that applies to defined contribution plans.
Well, one of the issues that has been contested in this case is whether the cash balance plan must comply with the defined benefit requirements, and we agree that it does. But we would look to the way the plan expresses the benefit. The question is, how do you measure the rate of benefit accrual?
You're filibustering. You're not dealing with my question. If you haven't focused on it, you can
just say,
I haven't focused on it. Fine. You don't have to filibuster.
Thank you. The plaintiff's analysis requires two separate steps. It first requires you to read into the statute the term accrued benefit, which does not appear in the statute. And the plaintiffs then argue that all of the interest up to age 65 must be counted in calculating the rate of benefit accrual. That reading violates a basic rule of statutory construction and is not a sensible construction because it requires that the rate of benefit accrual be measured in terms of the benefit payable at normal retirement age. Normal retirement age, age 65, what sense does it make to say as to someone who's 72 or 73 that they need to accrue a benefit payable at age 65? It's not a sensible interpretation of the statute, and given the rule of statutory construction, there's no reason to read into the words of this statute a term that it doesn't use. There are additional indications in the statute, including Clause 5, which says that in determining the rate of benefit accrual, you ignore the early retirement subsidies. That clause would make no sense whatsoever if you read benefit accrual to mean the accrued benefit or the benefit payable at normal retirement age, because by definition, those benefits do not include the early retirement subsidy. But even if you were to read the statute, as plaintiff suggests, as requiring an analysis of the benefit payable at normal retirement age, the question would arise, is any decline in the rate of benefit accrual because of the attainment of any age? Here, employees earn interest because they wait to receive their benefit, not because of their age. Any two employees who wait 10 years receives 10 years of interest on their pay credit. And they receive interest at exactly the same rate regardless of their age. In order to determine whether the reduction in the rate of accrual is because of age, you have to look at the other factors, such as the passage of time. Here, if you look at that, the way to look at whether the passage of time, the different dates on which a benefit is being paid, accounts for the difference is to discount it to present value. And here, if you discount to present value, the benefits of an older and younger employee accrued up to age 65, they are identical. The account balances are identical. And therefore, if
they're identical, if we think this interest rate of Treasury plus 1% is the real economic rate, may be too low, is the
right,
or it may be too high if you filter out tax benefits. But if we assume that it's the real economic rate, then by definition they're identical. If it's not the real economic rate, then they depart.
Right, but not in the way exactly what the correct rate is. Is a little hard to discern. We submit an expert.
Right. In any event, it was not the holding of the district court in this case that Treasury plus 1% was the wrong rate.
Right. And we put in an affidavit from an MIT economist, and that was undisputed, that the rate used by the IBM plan is a reasonable calculation of the time value of money.
And I don't understand that at all. An economist gets the time value of money by reading it off of actual rates of return. He doesn't ask whether it's reasonable.
Well, it's a reasonable projection.
No. Well, I'm not going to pursue this. It's not the base of the district court's decision. But if you want to find out what the reasonable rate of return for investments of a particular kind is, you would look at what Vanguard's bond funds pay.
Or the Treasury rates.
No, you would not look at the Treasury rate. The Treasury rate is the risk-free rate. Corporations
right.
are not risk-free.
Right.
I think the shareholders of Enron and indeed these days of General Motors will tell you that corporations are not risk-free.
Right. And IBM adds one percentage point to the,
yes,
the Treasury
that's
rate
not, that's
to take
not
account.
What happens. What rate
to
does
take
IBM,
account of the risk.
Look, what rate does IBM pay on its long-term bonds? Is it Treasury plus 1%? It can't get anybody to lend money to IBM at Treasury plus 1%. It is not the economic rate for the risk that IBM is having creditors bear. Now, as I say, it doesn't matter in this case, but you shouldn't stand up and say this is the real economic rate when it transparently is not. Unless IBM can sell long-term bonds in the market at Treasury plus 1%, this is not the real rate.
I will not. I mean, there's no need for me to argue that point, and I take your point. And I also agree that that is not the basis of the district court's decision or the plaintiff's argument. They are not contesting the particular interest rate used by the plan. The one important point about the plan and about the defined benefit requirements is that a defined benefit plan determines what the benefit is by stating a formula. And here, the defined benefit plan defines the benefit as an immediate lump sum equal to the pay credits and the interest credits. That is the promise of this plan, and that is the reality that in terms of the benefits of employees. And so when we get to the question of how do you calculate the rate of benefit accrual, it's our position that you look at the plan. You look at what the plan says is the benefit and how it expresses the benefit. It can express the benefit as an immediate lump sum. It can express it as an annuity payable at age 65. It can express it as an annuity payable immediately. All of those are permissible forms of benefit. And what the IBM plan does is express it in terms of the immediate lump sum. When we then ask, how do you determine whether the rate of benefit accrual decreases, you look at the formula as expressed by the plan. The plaintiffs say there's only one way of looking at benefits in terms of the accrued benefit based upon a statutory provision. But it's simply not true that that is the only benefit. And when Congress wants you to look at that benefit, the benefit payable at normal retirement age, what it does is it uses the term accrued benefit or the term benefit payable at normal retirement age. Here, it didn't use those words. And under the rules of construction, that choice not to use the specialized terms is to be treated as a deliberate choice on the part of Congress. The plaintiffs take the position that their reading of the statute is the only permissible one, and therefore they ignore all of the consequences of the decision, including its effect on other plans. But their analysis, if applied to other plans, would also strike down index career pay plans, variable annuity plans, and other plans that existed long before this provision was enacted. Your Honor, if I may reserve the rest of my time.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Mr. Freeman.
May it please the court. Defendant IBM conceded that or agreed that this plan must comply with the defined benefit rules. And it's also conceded that if you look at the table on page 11 of our brief, and if you apply that to a defined benefit plan, it would violate
That table reflects the time value of money.
Well,
and the district court held, I mean, this is the district court's own statement. It said that the reason why this plan violates the statute is because younger workers wait longer until retirement, and so the time value of money adds up. And that leads to my question, which I have already telegraphed, whether in your view every defined benefit plan that has ever existed violates ERISA, every defined contribution plan violates ERISA.
The answer to your question is on page 2 of our brief, and the answer to your question is the difference between a defined benefit plan and a defined contribution plan. In a defined contribution plan...
You know exactly what they are. I'm asking about the statute. The rule on which the district court relied, and which you relied in section 204B1H, is repeated and applied to defined contribution plans almost verbatim in section 204B2A. So if allowing the time value of money to be used in a defined benefit plan violates 204B1H, it seems to me that it also violates 204B2A, and all defined contribution plans are now unlawful. And that's the question I'm asking. Do you have the courage of your convictions, and if not, why not?
No, I have the courage of my convictions, and I respectfully disagree with what you just said. That if for a defined contribution plan, ERISA defines the accrued benefit as the, quote, balance in the individual's account, and that's ERISA section 3, paren 23. And in Section 204B2A, the statute provides that a defined contribution satisfies the benefit accrual requirements as long as the allocations to the employee's account are not ceased and the rate at which the amounts are allocated to the employee's account are not reduced because of age. So it envisions, and that's what a defined contribution plan is, the employer makes contributions to the plan. The employee has an account that is completely different from a defined benefit plan, as the court stressed in Berger, where the account balance is a fiction. And an account, for a defined benefit plan, the touchstone is the accrued benefit must be valued in terms of the annuity that it will yield at the normal retirement age. And this goes to another question that you asked, Your Honor. You said, gee, look at the two different rates of return. What does it mean for IBM? Well, Judge Murphy made findings as to what it meant to IBM. When IBM went into a defined benefit plan, into this cash balance plan, it saved several hundred million dollars, but it made $1.2 billion because the interest that it earned on the amount that it supposedly, that it purportedly allocated to the defined benefit plan, to the cash balance plan, far exceeded the interest it was paying the employees. That's why it adopted the plan. It got the advantage of earning that interest and reporting it as income on its balance sheet. The trade-off there is that the law promises the employee that there will be no age discrimination, and regardless of his age, he will get an age 65 annuity. And Berger stressed that you begin by valuing the age 65 annuity. You take what is in the account and you value the age 65. You take the account, then you have to add interest credits to
65. Can you think of 65. Any reason, Mr. Freeman, why we should read these two subsections of the statute differently so that what is lawful for a defined contribution plan is unlawful for a plan that is essentially a phantom defined contribution plan?
Well,
that is, it has the very same economic attributes as a defined contribution plan, but it's an imputed account rather than an actual account.
It doesn't have the same economic attributes because there is no actual contribution in a cash balance plan. It's all an accounting fiction, and that's what this court held in Berger. There is no... If that were true, there would have been no reason for Treasury to labor so hard and diligently as it has in the and unsuccessfully as it has since the enactment of these cash balance plans. If you read the 2002 regulations that Treasury proposed, Treasury says, under a literal reading of the statute, these hybrid plans result in age discrimination, and we therefore are going to change the law. We are going to create an exception to the defined benefit rules in order to...
Mr. Freeman, would you deal with my question? From the perspective of the employee, a phantom defined contribution plan, it's technically legally a defined benefit plan, but it has the same economic attributes as an actual defined contribution plan from which you can't withdraw until you reach retirement age. Why should we view these two clauses, which look for all the world like they have almost identical language, as having dramatically different effects whether the account is funded or unfunded?
Because the Berger cases teaches you that they're dramatically different.
Forget the Berger case. I'm asking, is there a reason why, when you've got very similar economic attributes, identical as the employee sees it, and very similar, if not identical, language, we should read them differently?
Yes.
All right, what's that reason?
In a defined benefit plan, the employee gets the contribution. The employee gets the in a defined benefit plan, the employee gets the contribution based on years of service times percentage of salary times the interest that's accrued over that period of time. In a cash balance plan, the requirement is, as set forth in 96.8 and as implemented in Esden and Berger, that not only does the employee get what is there at the time he terminates, but he immediately gets interest credits to age 65. And those interest credits accrue immediately. And therefore, that is why you have to analyze the benefit under a cash balance plan, under a defined benefit plan, in terms of the age 65 annuity. It is simply wrong to say it's the account balance is equal to the projected value at age 65. You can't read accrued benefit in 204, Section 204 as account balance. And that it has to be the accrued balance, the accrued benefit as set forth in Section 3-23 of the code. I'd like to interrupt just for a second and point out to the court that none of the arguments that IBM makes would save the always cash balance enhancement, because the always cash balance enhancement was a one-time bump up for younger employees. So even if you looked at it in this present value way, it would still be illegal. The older employees were allowed to have an opening balance that was equal to their account balance in the old defined benefit plan, and the younger employees were given the option to take a larger amount as though there had always been an always cash balance always cash balance plan. There was no real choice, and there was an immediate and dramatic change in the account balances depending on age, as their actuary recognized.
Well, wait a minute. As far as the cash balance plan, if a 30-year-old works for IBM until he's 50, he will have gotten 10% or whatever, it's 5% of his salary and interest, whatever the formula is, for that 20 years. If a 45-year-old works till 65, he gets the same, 10 or 5% plus that interest rate for that same 20 years. The difference is that the one who leaves IBM at 50 has another 15 years of interest accumulation, whereas the one who leaves at 65 does not. Is that your problem, because the younger one's going to have more simply because he left earlier and had more time to accumulate interest?
Well,
otherwise it's all equal, isn't it?
No. There's no under a traditional defined benefit plan, there is no adjustment for interest. And this is a defined benefit plan. There is an adjustment for, obviously, if you have a defined contribution plan, you're getting actual credits every year and you're earning them. But this is a defined benefit plan. And in a defined benefit plan, those two people, if they retired, should have the same age 65 annuity.
With that difference in age.
Even though the difference in age. It's shown on page 13 of our brief. They should have the same age 65 annuity, the same payments per month. They should be equal. That's what the law is with respect to defined benefit plans. Now, the law is different with respect to defined contribution plans because the corporation makes an actual contribution. And, yes, IBM is trying to squeeze its plan into the defined contribution mold, but it can't because the law requires immediate accrual of interest credits to age 65, and that immediate accrual of interest credits means that those age 65 annuities have to be the same. It's similar to a equal cost defense. I mean, they're claiming that they give each person the same amount, but so therefore, it's a bona fide plan, and it's equal cost and equal benefit. But the statute specifically, 423B, specifically exempts, specifically says the equal cost defense does not apply to the prohibition against reducing the rate of benefit accrual. And there is a way to do it. There is a way to do it. The statute in the next subsection, B2, says that you can reduce benefits based on years of service. And if IBM did that, if IBM said we will cap benefits based on years of service, that would pass muster. But what they've but when you start, as you must start, that's the law. Age 55 annuity is the benefit, the accrued benefit that's promised by ERISA and enforced by the court. When you start with age 55 and you say you're entitled to an annuity beginning at age 55, when you measure the difference between employees, you're subtracting an employee's age at 30 from 55 and an employee at 45 from 55, so it's solely dependent on age. The difference in the annuity that he gets is solely dependent on age, if you permit IBM to give the younger employees more. The statute...
Are you talking about the cash balance plan or the always...
No, the cash balance plan.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm missing it, because it seems to me if you give them the same... I'm talking about same salary, same time frame, same interest rate. Everything's the same, except one employee happens to be older than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, if you say, let's just say 65, they both choose to cash in. One's going to cash in 20 years earlier than the other with the same amount of money put in. And it seems to me that the one who waits longer gets more.
Well, the fact of the matter is, in terms of time value of money, that's true. But the law provides.
You say the law is just counter to that. It says that won't work.
Yeah, the law provides that you cannot give the age 55 or 60 year old guy a lower annuity just because he's older. You can't
favor.
Well,
no, but
favor
it's everything. There's no age factor in there. At least the way I see it. If you put it in those terms, it may be that if somebody like me, I'm 64. If I start work someplace, I don't expect to get 1 year, but somebody that's worked there 30 years is going to get the same thing.
But you're not starting from scratch. You're starting from the fact that these rules have developed for defined benefit plans, and this is a defined benefit plan, and IBM concedes that the chart on page 11 shows a reduction in rate of benefit accrual under a defined benefit plan. It is simply arguing that its cash balance plan is something different than the traditional defined benefit plan because it gives these hypothetical credits. And so it says it should be judged under the defined contribution plan, and I emphasize that there are substantial differences in the way that the law treats these plans because the corporations get an economic benefit from the defined benefit formula and using the cash balance hybrid form and reporting the income. Now, I think this is most dramatically shown if you study the 2002 Treasury regulations that were proposed. Treasury was making the same argument that Judge Easterbrook was making. Treasury says this makes no sense. The older guy should get less because the younger guy has to wait longer for his money. But it says if we apply the statute, the result is different. The result is age discrimination if we apply the statute. So if you read those, and we've cited them, if you read the Treasury regulations, they go through this whole argument. And they say, we want to protect these companies against this statutory violation. So from now on, the regulations are prospective. We cite them in our brief, 67 FR 76123. And they really tell the whole story. They say, these issues have been raised because because it does, in fact, discriminate against older people if you try to use this cash balance vehicle to fund a defined benefit plan. And it says, from now on, when these regulations get adopted, when these regulations become final after comment, they say on page 10, they say, from now on, 14, we will say that it's okay. We will read benefit accrual to refer to the annual contribution to the plan. We will treat the IBM plan as legal once these regulations are adopted. The problem is that these regulations were withdrawn. They weren't adopted. Congress has refused to permit the Treasury to adopt regulations that will make this legal. So it is still age discriminatory. It's just a fact. It's just the way you have to read ERISA. ERISA's a very strict and very specific statute. But the one thing I would like to emphasize in terms of the impact of this decision, first of all, the defendant damages were settled. Judge Murphy rejected the damage claim cited by IBM as one of the horribles in its brief. But more than that, the issues that it raises here in terms of impact go to the remedy, go to what will happen. And as the Supreme Court teaches in Manhart Norris, the district courts have a great deal of discretion over the remedy that will be fashioned if the court finds a violation, as it must in this instance. There is a violation. There is age discrimination. But the remedy here has been settled. It's a small impact on IBM. And all these other problems that they raise really should wait another day. I see my time is up if you have no further questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Anything further, counsel?
Just briefly, Your Honor. In response to Judge Mannion's point, if two employees have worked 10 years, one's age 65 and the other's age 50, the younger employee, the age 50 employee, will only obtain the additional 15 years of interest if he waits 15 years longer to receive his benefits. And the value of his benefit, even if he waits the 15 years, gets the additional 15 years of interest, the value is essentially no different from the value of the older employee who takes his benefit immediately, unless, as Judge Easterbrook points out, the interest rate is a little bit low, in which case the younger employee actually obtains a little bit less. In terms of the 2002 proposed regulations that have been withdrawn, I think there are few documents in Treasury that deserve less weight in connection with litigation than proposed regulations where Treasury said do not rely on them and then withdrew them. But it's simply not the case that those regulations stated that cash balance plans were unlawful. Quite the contrary. Just briefly on the question of the always cash balance plan, which is actually a large issue, not very much addressed in the case, but we think it's a very straightforward issue. All the ACB, the always cash balance plan did was to establish an age-neutral benefit floor. For new employees going into the cash balance plan, it simply treated them, gave them an optional benefit as if they'd always been in the cash balance plan, and it was age-neutral. What the plaintiffs complain about is the effect of an age-neutral plan, and they complain that the effect was to help younger employees more than older employees. Well, it only had that effect because the other formula used to establish the opening balances favored older employees. So in all cases, in terms of the opening account balances, the older employees started off with a larger balance than the younger employee. That was true in all cases. And this court had decided in the Finnegan case a very similar issue involving vacation plan that favored older employees, and then the company imposed an age-neutral benefit cap, which had the effect of reducing the benefits of the older employees. And the court said it's simply not age discrimination to impose an age-neutral cap. And it's even clearer then that imposing an age-neutral benefit floor is not age discrimination. It's treating all employees the same, and the fact that there is an effect is not grounds for saying that that there's any discrimination because of age. That was the court's holding in Finnegan, and that holding is reaffirmed by the Supreme Court decision in City of Jackson, which makes clear that disparate impact claims cannot be asserted based on the kind of because of language that appears in ERISA 204B1H and that is comparable to ADEA Section 4A1, and that disparate impact claims are limited to 4A2 claims. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.